Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, my special guest is Maria Guerrero, a social entrepreneur, leadership educator, and facilitator working at the intersection of social change, collective learning, and human development. She began her career as a lawyer and an economist in corporate law, and then she founded Acción por la Música, an innovative organization in Spain that uses collective music making to foster inclusion, community, and social transformation. In 2024, Maria was listed among the 25 most influential Spaniards in the third sector, and in 2018, she was named as one of the top 100 women leaders in Spain. Today, she teaches leadership at Camillas University, works internationally as a facilitator and advisor, and is pursuing doctoral research on leadership development. At the heart of her work is the belief that the most important challenges cannot be solved by expertise alone. They require people to learn, to adapt, and to discover new possibilities. Maria has three children and is passionately dedicates her life to social transformation. Maria, you are very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I'm very happy to be here with you. This is great. What an introduction.
Yes. We planned it well. For the audience, Maria and I met in Roma. In Rome, we were working on a leadership project led by the Jesuits in the Catholic Church. And Maria does quite a lot of work in that space. I believe you're traveling to Africa tomorrow. Where are you going?
I'm going to be in Zambia, working alongside contemplative nuns and monks.
Fascinating. So where should we begin? Leadership, development. Where is your passion taking you at the moment? What's leading you at the moment, Maria?
I'm in love with human development. I'm in love with leadership. With leadership understood as the ability to effect change. That's what really keeps me awake.
and to effect change, you're very focused on social change, is it specifically the education and religious sectors? Is it any sector? Where do you normally work? Where do you like to work?
I like to work with institutions and persons that have a sense of purpose. I don't think you need my help if you want to sell more shoes, which is perfectly fantastic. But my work has to do with change being a deep realization for every human and for every organization, and the sense that we're invited to higher levels of consciousness.
And what challenges are you specifically seeing in your work? Tell me some of the sort of major sort of challenges you come up against.
That's a good one. So I work a lot with education institutions, with church institutions, and there's one big issue about authority and power. What really is a place for authority, for older generations and companies? What role does authority have to play? And that also has to do with what is the role of the expert in a world that is increasingly enigmatic and mysterious. Can someone really advance change only through expertise or having very clear answers to questions? So that's one big thing. There are other big things that I worry about, which is I believe that since everything is so complex, we're usually trying to find an easy position about things, that we're at least able to understand ourselves. So this usually takes us to oversimplifying. And I think one form, one shape it's taking is playing the role of a victim.
Yes. That's an interesting one. In my work, I talk a lot about the wounded self and the celebrated self, how people kind of polarize themselves into always pathologizing or being the victim, or there's like a narrative around victimhood, which is very popular. And then there's another polarization, which is about the positive mindset, like and almost getting lost and denying the kind of the wounded self, and the wounded self denies the celebrated self, and they get kind of split off. And I think a lot of my work is to bring it together.
Sorry, there was a call. I need to close the window. Yeah, please go on.
Yeah, I'm. Let's go back to the authority question, because I mean, when I work in Rome with the church and in different religious settings, I find it very helpful for the rest of my work. I work a lot in all sorts of areas, whether it's corporate life or banks, or I work in the humanitarian sector. And I find the church, I think, because it's such an established institution, that they've been struggling with this, and it's so clear, the authority is so clear there. You know, you have the Pope, and you have the bishops, and you have the lay people, and there's different kind of layers of authority. And yet at the same time, they try and live through gospel love. They try and live through a very egalitarian framework. And I find this very interesting.
It's paradoxical, isn't it? I think there's one thing there. There's one miscomprehension that is very spread, and it happens a lot in the church, which is to believe that someone who is higher up in the hierarchy is closer to God and can know better what God wants. Mm. Whereas the basic experience of any human life is that everyone experiences the contact with mystery, and therefore we're all the right person to listen to that mystery, whether it be God or any other form of mystery or transcendence. So I think that is one of the causes for abuse of power in the church or any other faith-based institution.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I don't think that, I think the church shows that very clearly. And I think, but it's not limited to the church. So if I go into a corporation, people with a higher rank also feel they are closer to, whether it's a god of money or the god of success or the god of material goodness, whatever it is. But then there's a similar kind of experience that marginal voices are not that important or not that worthy. And I think that these parallel kind of, these institutions are parallel, but they just have different kind of names for it.
Mm-hmm. And the same happens, for example, in universities with the doctors that create knowledge, and everyone else just receives that knowledge and does a secondhand thing that has to do with only applying it as mere and poor practitioners.
Yeah.
It's probably the same fallacy, right? And it has a lot to do with who, what it means to learn, what it means to know, who can learn and know, what is the source of what we need to know in order to act.
Yeah. Yeah, and who holds knowledge. And as you say, it's not just the expert or the professor. It's, you know, the lived knowledge of people in all different walks of life is huge. And if we listen, we can learn so much, but we often don't listen.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Because we often don't value. Mm. These categories have to do, this idea of power is not that the people in higher ranks are dominating others necessarily. It has to do with the fact that we all attribute more power to them. And we all listen other people more because of these ranks. The same reason why you probably presented me as someone who has been awarded the recognition of being whatever leader, which, you know, how much does that really make me someone that knows about leadership? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, one thing I've been very interested in, when I was younger, I was an anarchist and I was really into, like from a young age, I think I had a difficult childhood in terms of authoritarian figures in school. They weren't very nice, to be honest. It was not a good experience of authority. And so in my adolescence, I kind of turned to anarchism, not in a just a rebellious way, but I got very interested in how we deconstruct power, how we kind of move power. And then I realized quite soon on that that was kind of utopian and that power exists everywhere anyway. And since then, I've been on this long journey to try and understand power, hierarchy, authority. And quite recently, really, I've been trying to think about how hierarchy is not a negative thing, actually. And yet it often gets turned into something negative. As you say, kind of people attribute kind of too much power to it rather than seeing it as a useful part of a wider ecosystem. So in my work in ecosystem leadership now, eco leadership, we kind of often used to think about hierarchy over there. We don't want that. Now everything becomes leaderless or self-managed. And actually I find that that's a fallacy too. You get caught in two traps. How does the hierarchy work well in an ecosystem where we value all beings, all things, human and non-human?
This is so important. I tend to rely on this distinction by Ronald Heifetz that is the base of adaptive leadership, where we speak about technical problems or challenges and adaptive challenges. The first ones, the technical, being ones that can be solved from authority because they are known problems with known solutions that we only need to apply. Uh-huh. I think hierarchy is great for these. I think a school works very well with this hierarchy, a company, a bank, everything that can be, that can fit a process, a protocol. It is so much more efficient to already apply what we know is best and measure it and be very precise and rigorous. So that's, for me, the place of authority, the things we know and that already have a known solution that is the best. Everything else that we can call adaptive, where we don't know and we cannot know the solution beforehand because there is not such solution, but rather that we can advance, and where we actually can have a lot of uncertainty around the very nature of the problem, that is a space where everyone is responsible and where change can only happen if everyone is taking part.
That's an interesting distinction. I mean, my experience says that these things are quite blurred, though. That these so I work in a bank, I work in, like, for in recent years I've been working in a manufacturing company, like a world famous manufacturing company, where there's engineers and there's technical expertise, and it's like you have to apply systems and processes and stuff, and yet their biggest problem is collaborative working in complex ecosystems. And it's like, how does this technical knowledge, it can only work if people understand how to work together. So how do these two things really kind of come together?
They're always intertwined. And I think one of the best abilities that we can really train is to identify the adaptive nature of the situations that we're facing. So the difference, we can know the, and we can tell the difference, and we were talking about how we know. How do you know the difference? Well, you really know it in your guts. You might be doing something that seems very straightforward, a certain process, and then suddenly something comes up that has to do with collaborating with someone. You ask for something and they say no. and they're not helping, whatever it is, it can be very small, but it already has a different nature. So when we're trained for that, we can change the mode depending on what it requires.
Yeah. And also added to that, there's, I mean, I'm a critical theorist, so I think about power a lot, whether it's, and power relations. So within that, there's also power context. So in the church, there's a power context. In a manufacturing company, there's a power context. Like, and that gives you another quandary, like who has permission to ask a question and who is listened to when they answer a question and who isn't. As you know, as a woman in a boardroom, you know, different voices are weighted more than others. And we experience that in all walks of life in different ways. So this idea of critical theory of applying questions about who has a voice, who doesn't have a voice, why are they marginalized, also becomes part of this, because you can't have collaborative working unless you kind of ask those questions.
Absolutely. I think, and I have experienced that when you're working with a group that has to deal with power and authority, just the mere awareness of the power imbalance inside the group is already so much. So usually paying attention to how much time do people speak. Uh-huh. I often see it as a football game where we measure how much time one team or the other was in control of the ball. So this is actually the same. And helping people understand that, because usually you say, okay, some people speak less. And the first reaction is to say, well, that's because I'm shy.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe it's because you're shy, or maybe it's because you're a woman and you're the youngest person. And there are more variables. So I often, when the situation allows for it, I often do some exercises around demographic variables that do influence power, such as I was saying, age, socioeconomic background, gender, so many others. People used to say, if you ask people, do they influence us? No, they don't. Of course they don't. We're such an evolved organization. We have a delegate for diversity, equity, and inclusion. But then when you have observed who are the people that we're listening most to, and then you apply this filter of demographic variables, it's almost inevitable to accept that we all function in this way.
Yeah, and we all have many blind spots, even how well developed we are. I mean, I remember being in when I first entered the university and business school. My previous work was in the health sector. I was a nurse, and then I came into academia, the elite professions. And I'd never went to university as a younger man either, so it was quite a step into this new world, you know. And I remember I was on an international kind of executive MBA program teaching about human relationships. And I just remember it was so obvious, this ranking of who spoke the most. And it wasn't about age and gender, it was about nationalities. And it was just like the Americans were just very, very good at speaking first. And then the Germans and the Europeans followed. And then the Asian voices, who were very polite. And it was a cultural thing. And this pattern just went over and over again. And I used to find that if I just stopped the group and say, could we listen to the South Korean voices, please? Could we listen to the Chinese voices, please? You get this kind of, these pearls of wisdom, which they've been sitting on. They'd be sort of observing, deeply observing, being very reflective, and then they'd offer something because they'd been in that third position, and because they'd been in that observation position, making sense of what was going on. But these patterns kind of are, that they can be nationalistic, they can be kind of gender, they can be age, they can be many reasons.
And the fact is that we internalize them, so we're not aware of them, right? I think the way we experience them is that our voice is not really expected. Nobody is wanting to really hear what we have to say. And you can tell that when you're in a group. There are groups where I speak with great confidence, and there are other places where I feel that I need to ask for permission, and I just tiptoe very quickly and say three ideas without developing them. So that's the way I have become aware of that, in the way I feel when I'm speaking. Right now, I'm feeling very comfortable. So this is a good place.
Yeah, no, it's one of the exercises I do with groups, and to think that not just say kind of, are you an extra or are you an introvert? It's like, where do you find your voice is heard? Where do you find yourself comfortable to speak? Where not? And that kind of contextual experience tells you an awful lot about the person and their upbringing and what they bring to the game, and kind of what the context kind of does to them as well. It's like, what does it do to us, and kind of and why does that do it to us? And it's not universal. So you have two women in the same room, and one feels very confident to speak, and one doesn't feel very confident to speak because of their own personal kind of backgrounds.
Yeah, and that's one other thing that I realized. In our culture, we're so much about speaking. It's like if you exercise power, it has to be through what you say and the way you say it. And it doesn't really have to be like that. Not even everyone in our world and culture operates in that way. So I very often like to do somatic work. Yeah. I like to work with the body. I remember one day I was facilitating with this group where there was this great diversity, and people from the global south would speak less, and some of them had true barriers with the language. So at some point I turned on the music, and I played music from different parts of the world. And at this point there was this woman who came from Kenya, actually. She stood up and started to dance, and she just took the whole space in the center of the room with so much confidence and so much grace. And that moment changed the power dynamics in the group.
No, you're right. And one of the problems with technology aided speech these days through AI, etc., is that people think that the volume, whether the amount matters, you know. So if you can produce more stuff, if you can speak more, either through your voice or through the amount of stuff you put out in the world, it's kind of gives you more power or more reach. And we're getting overloaded, just overloaded with stuff. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I believe we need some space to discern what really makes sense, what has this, the really important things have this, would you call that gravitational force in English? Or they have this gravity, they have this weight.
Yeah.
And they attract, they generate this attraction, which is almost like physical, certain ideas, certain works, certain, and that actually calls for our intuition and our more emotional self, which are capacities that we just usually don't trust. We just go with the rational part.
Yeah, and we've also got less and less comfortable with kind of silence and thinking. It's something I noticed because I spend time in monasteries, and I'm a Quaker, so we spend time in Quaker meetings and sitting in silence is kind of what we do, you know. you wait for the spirit to kind of enter your body, and if you feel a somatic quaking of the body, you think, okay, now is my time to speak. But it's a very, very countercultural experience to be in silence, even with yourself. It's like, you know, to be in silence with yourself and allow yourself to kind of think and allow your unconscious or your spirit to emerge and to process stuff. You know, we're just filled with noise a lot. So I think it's one of the greatest problems with the coaches I train is they find it very hard to hold their tongue.
Yeah.
It's like they have to jump in and be clever or try and impress or be a good coach, you know, and perform what a good coach means. And mm-hmm. a good coach means just witnessing, just being there, just being present, just accompanying. Mm. It's a lot like a lost art.
Yeah, it's like thinking that you have to have the right answer for things that probably don't even have a right answer and maybe just are asking for us to be present and available for them. I have, I love that explanation about what it means to be a Quaker from my perspective, from Ignatian discernment,
mm-hmm.
from St. Ignatius. He talks about spiritual dynamics. You can feel consoled in consolation or in desolation. Consolation is this bright dynamic, right, where you're experiencing joy and hope and fluidity. And in desolation, you might feel more stuck and you can feel this disequilibrium, this uncertainty, this fear. Very often people think that the desolation is like the bad thing and consolation is a good thing. Where actually everything that is really meaningful is preceded by desolation, but by this tremor, by this disequilibrium, fear, not being able to make sense of that. But we tend to withdraw. We're so used to controlling things, to knowing what things are. And that's because we've built a domesticated world.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we use a phrase from Donna Haraway a lot in our work. We talk about staying with the trouble. And it's like when you're feeling that desolation, that discomfort, that anxiety, that not knowing, that you stay with it and you allow that to compost. You allow that to, we talk about composting as well, because I used to think about reflection, and reflection is a very heady place. It's a very sort of, you know, it's a very cognitive experience. You know, I reflect on something. Yeah. To compost something is to allow the waste to surface, allow it to the nutrients to break down. If something happens, like your body processes your thoughts as well as your mind, and it's allowing that process. And to compost, for me, you have to move your body. You know, you have to physically move and maybe go into nature. So we have breaks and I say, go and compost. And everyone goes off into their gardens or nature, or they eat or they drink, and their bodies become alive. And then something else happens. It's very, so interesting. And then you come back and it's a very different energy, very different understanding of processing.
That's very interesting. Because I often find also that what we need is movement. So change has to do with actually deep and subtle movement rather than substituting one thing for the other. And when we approach these things, we think that we need to meditate in complete silence and experience a total void of thought so that we can progress. And that just doesn't happen. It has more to do with using other energies. Just not only the head, not only the mind, the cognitive part. So it has to do with activating what's alive for us, who we are, below the neck.
Yeah. And of course, our nervous systems, you know, we talk about, like, we know this stuff because we talk about, I had a gut feeling.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, our gut feeling is real. Like, you know, our nervous system does travel to our guts, and our guts does kind of pick up nervousness and anxieties, and it does kind of process and do work for us as well. So yeah, and the body, you know, as we know, our muscle, everything, the tensions we hold, you know, they're telling us something if we are able to listen.
Yeah, because what we are, who we are, what we experience emotion. We are emotion.
Yeah,
in the body, I think. The fact that there is artificial intelligence now and so much going on in technology is really going to help us probably understand that being a human is not only about technical rationality and moving ideas. Having a body, being a body, is an absolute privilege.
Yeah. No, I'm hoping that I'm hoping that whilst there's huge dangers with AI, and you know, there's many critiques of it, and many uses of it, you know, in medically and stuff, it's going to be very helpful. You can see these, but there's a lot of fear around it. And Pope Leo has just written his first encyclical on it, which I've not read yet. But
I have.
Yeah, tell us about it. Give us a brief summary.
You know what I liked about it? The fact that, so there is an anthropology to all of this. That's what is being now questioned. We thought that we were rational animals, right? And something he brings up is frigidity. That's probably one of the most human experiences, and how we come to terms with it and value it as, yeah. I think it's that's one lovely little gem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now I write a few years ago, it's COVID actually, it came to me that the fragility of humanity just came like in a wave, you know, like we were suddenly completely out of control, you know, it's like we were like, this virus thing came upon us, and I started to write about the precarious interdependent world, because it revealed our precariousness, our fragility. It revealed, you know, and that's actually the state we're always in. We kind of try and hide behind like a modernity or stability, and actually now it's always precarity, it's always there. And the other part of it is the interdependence, and our interdependence is can lead to kind of viral plagues, or they can lead to kind of environmental breakdown, or they can lead to beautiful life, you know, and healthy living, you know, but you can't ignore either of those things, that kind of fragility, that precariousness, and our interdependence with our, each other, with nature. Is just kind of, it kind of hit me during that COVID period.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is what came afterwards. We used to say, we will come out better than we entered. And I think what we really meant was that the realization of our fragility and interdependence would change the world.
Mm.
And it has, right? It has changed the world in many ways we aren't able to process yet. But what have you been sensing about that? What have we become? What are we becoming?
I mean, I think there's many stories about what we are becoming. I don't think there's one story, but there's definitely kind of a strong global kind of reaction towards building walls, trying to defend ourselves against the viruses of the world. And the viruses might be immigration, or they might be kind of bugs, or they might be, you know, so there's like there's a mental kind of defense mechanism which is kind of trying to defend against the fears which have arisen. And you see that politically, you see that in many kind of forms, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there's counter narratives around some really beautiful work being done by so many people, which doesn't hit the news so often, but is kind of in everyday life, you know. I live, when the Ukraine war broke out, we hosted two Ukrainian sisters. They lived with us for a year, and there's Ukrainians in the hotel next to us, and every morning there's an elderly man, and we make peace with him. And you know, there's very small acts around me and everywhere where people are kind of showing great compassion and understanding and development, but that doesn't get the news stuff. So I think for me, there's lots of different narratives going on. Some of it kind of frightening, and some of it kind of very, very encouraging.
Mm, yeah, and they're all part of the same. I guess that it's really not easy to have such an exposure to others that are so different and that want things that are fundamentally different. Because we humans have been living in small groups forever, a family, a village, a place where we knew who we were. We knew what was expected from us. We knew what was right and what was wrong. We could challenge it, but we knew what we were challenging. Right now, our neighbor, person who lives next door, can be so fundamentally different. And at the same time, on television, on social media, we are in touch with people that are so, so different. So I don't think we're actually equipped for this life. It's natural to want to build walls, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there's the great cities of where difference comes together. So in Seville, where the Muslims and the Christians and the Jews in Cordoba and the great cosmopolitan cities where travel. I mean, it's very interesting for me. I'm from Bristol, and that was a port, and there's a lot of early immigration there, so it becomes part of your cosmopolitan life in London, and so there's a great kind of joy in learning in cosmopolitan life and indifference, as well as a great fear, and I think it's how it's managed, how it's contained, how we process it.
Exactly. It's the same we were saying before. When you're faced with something that challenges you, then what do you do? It's easier to withdraw and to attack than it is to really remain open and actually even question yourself.
And there's also a fantasy about that if you get rid of all the others or the other people or the people not like us, then there'll be some sort of utopian peace or and actually there's always difference, whether it's always. Whether it's gender or whether it's kind of an intellect or whether it's kind of ability or disability, there's like in any you never get this idea of a pure homogenous group, you know. So we get to a nice white Christian country and a nice patriarchal leadership and everything's going to be well. Well, no. I'm sorry, but no.
No, it doesn't happen that way. The thing is that the thought that we can only be with someone that is just like us takes us to war. It's actually the ability to be with someone that's different, to be part of a community, to love someone even though you don't really understand them that well. You accept them, they accept you. I do a lot of work in peace building and conflict transformation. For example, I've been working a lot in Venezuela. You know, that conflicts need to be transformed before, during, and after.
Yeah.
So throughout all this time, what I observe is that it is really possible to make way together, to join together, to acknowledge our interdependence, and to acknowledge that there's something more important than our points of view.
I
think that's the thing, right? When there is a higher purpose, when there is a future, a land, a cause.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing some work at the moment. We talk about the soul at work and try and understand kind of where the soul is in this life, because for me this idea of transcendence, and whether you believe in God or not God, or whether you believe in kind of a deep humanity or in nature, whatever your kind of belief is, it has to become part of this story. It has to become part of it, because it's been left out and we've just focused on the rational, like you say, or the cognitive or the materialistic. And unless you bring this back and find a way, and most people kind of acknowledge this when given the space to acknowledge it, like people have spiritual lives, they have a kind of understanding of a deeper kind of humanity, a deeper kind of sense of self, a soul, whether it's however you want to describe it, it's there in people. And if I mean, my experience in coaching and in the work, if you kind of create the space for it, it just emerges, it comes, it surfaces, you know, but it's about being able to create the space for that to happen. And when that happens, lots of other things happen.
Yeah, I agree. I feel that there is a source of life for us, something that makes us really come alive, and we can tune into that. I love our common friend Elias López once defined it for me, the spiritual realm, if you want, as one of union, where I am, and connection, where I am simultaneously connected with myself, with you, with every human being at the same time, mm-hmm. with nature, and probably something that transcends us. And there are peak experiences where we can really feel that.
Yeah.
And they can signal the way for us. So, because the only way to really recognize what your source of life is not through thought, is by experiencing this deep connection and then seeing what prompted it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I have a friend from Australia, and she's from the indigenous peoples of Australia, and she talks about the relationality, and it's the same thing. It's about being in relation, whether it's with nature, with your ancestors, with yourself. Mm-hmm. This kind of relationality is so important. Mm-hmm. Maria, we're coming to the end of the podcast. It's been a very rich conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we say goodbye to our audience?
That I've enjoyed it very much. And that I believe these conversations are urgent. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I would love to be in touch with everyone that's listening. Just contact me on LinkedIn or wherever you find me.
Very good. So thank you so much indeed. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Safe travels to your next place. And we will talk again. Goodbye for now.
Bye.